clients today. We had an anthropologist and a person in social work. Next, we have someone from political science, and finally, our discussant will be from sociology. You haven't denounced sociology lately, have you? Or renounced it? He's still a sociologist.
I got degrees in geography, though.
Oh, a geographer. A human geographer.
I'll explain this later.
Okay. But we do have a good representation of the social sciences today. Next, Mrs. Grace Wolf from Department of Political Science, a graduate student in political science at the University of Chicago. Is that correct? Okay, she will speak on Native politics and overview.
I think I should preface these remarks by saying that most of the information or the conclusions that I've reached have developed over a period of a year and a half in which I've been doing research on my dissertation in Alaska, and most of this is from interviews. Unfortunately, the topic of Native politics is such an involved one that a paper for this conference has to be quite a summary, and some of it will appear a little simplistic, and may I warn you that the factors are quite a bit more complex than they seem. The 60,000 Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts of Alaska are currently engaged in a political struggle to secure their rights as human beings and as American citizens. This struggle is focused on the land they claim to be theirs through Aboriginal title, but which they now stand to lose through governmental action. As Americans, they are more than willing to cede title to this land in order that the United States and Alaska may benefit from its development. But they also believe they are as entitled as other Americans to receive a just compensation when government exercises what is in effect a power of eminent domain. Beyond their property rights as American citizens, the natives feel the land issue involves their fundamental rights to human dignity. After decades of subjection to American colonialism, they are no longer content to live with the degradation the system imposes. Therefore, they demand that whatever land and money is awarded, they, not the Bureau of Indian Affairs nor any other governmental designee, have control over it. Essentially, the issue is whether natives have the same property rights as non-natives, that is, whether they will be compensated for their land, and if so, whether they will have control over the use of that compensation. These are the rights all other Americans take for granted, but which are in question when natives are involved. This paper is an attempt to identify the dimensions of the Alaskan Natives' political response to America's continued colonialism. It entails a discussion of the internal dynamics of their political development and an examination of the political situation with which they are confronted. Hopefully, it will result in a clearer understanding of the complex forces shaping Native politics. White America's imposition on Alaska's Natives has been a remarkably close reenactment of classical colonialism. Beginning with the official designation of uncivilized tribes in the Treaty of Cession with Russia, the natives were early confronted with the humiliation and degradation of federal wardship, including colonial administrators with all the trappings of superiority they could muster. Not to be outdone, the missionaries followed close behind to save the souls of the heathen, and in the process to help destroy the rich cultures and strong identities of these Northern Americans. This colonial mentality was rapidly adopted by the white settlers during territorial days and has continued into statehood. Today, some Alaskans in positions of political authority still speak condescendingly of our natives, children incapable of independent activity. This colonial mentality has also allowed government officials to believe native property rights are somehow distinct from those of other Americans. For example, last year the governor of Alaska successfully blocked the Kuskokwim River Fishermen's Cooperative's attempt to sell fish directly to the Japanese, while white businessmen did so with his blessing. Again, for example, the Bureau of Land Management has for years neglected, lost, and denied the very existence of the repeated filings of land claims by the Athabascans of Tana Cross. Both aspects of this colonial mentality, paternalism and property rights, were involved in an incident that backfired and became the basis around which the natives' emerging political consciousness organized. In his interim report of July 1966 to the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs glibly stated that his bureau would make recommendations to Congress for the settlement of native land claims. Native land rights had been at issue since Congress passed the Organic Act of 1884, which stipulated that natives would not be disturbed in the use or occupancy of their land, and that the determination of their title would be reserved to Congress. Although subsequent legislation enabled individual natives or native villages to acquire restricted title to limited areas, the Bureau of Land Management refused to act on most of these claims, and Congress has yet to determine conclusively native land rights. With statehood, however, the situation became critical. The Statehood Act specified state selection of approximately 104 million acres within 25 years. To the natives, this posed the ominous threat of expropriation, since much of the land they use and occupy contains valuable mineral resources over which the state wanted control. This immediate threat to their land, and thus their traditional way of life, stimulated the emergence of local native organizations throughout Alaska. These organizations almost immediately filed blanket land claims, eventually totaling 340 million acres, and began the push for a settlement. Thus, Emil Nadi, then president of the Cook Inlet Native Association, learned from an already published report that the Bureau of Indian Affairs planned to handle the native case in Washington. Neither he nor any other native leader had been consulted, yet this was a native issue of unprecedented importance and one which they had initiated themselves. It takes little imagination to picture the feelings of Nadi and other native leaders. They had no intention of entrusting their land rights now to an agency that had let the issue stagnate for decades and had proved itself to be more committed to its own interests than those of the natives. Mr. Nadi called for a statewide meeting of native leaders in Anchorage for mid-October 1966. The fact that over 200 regional and local leaders showed up was of historic importance. Attempts at statewide organization had been made before, but little beyond intensified regional activity had ever emerged. At the October meeting, however, the situation had changed. The people were ready and they had the issue, land. Within 3 days, these representatives were united in a common cause and the decision was made to establish a statewide organization. As a result, the Alaska Federation of Natives emerged in early 1967. From the beginning, the internal obstacles to effective organization seemed overwhelming. The AFN is a coalition of 19 regionally and culturally diverse native groups throughout Alaska. To compound the difficulties of historical distrust, separate languages, and regionalism among the natives, the economic costs of travel and communication in Alaska are high. But since the effectiveness of the AFN depended upon the natives' widespread understanding of and commitment to the land claims, some system of communication had to be developed. The bulk of this task has fallen to the regional leaders who serve as a crucial link between the villages and the statewide organization. Aiding their effort has been the increased circulation of the native newspaper Tundra Times to every village in the state. The AFN, from its inception, also faced potentially disintegrating political conflicts. The decision to decentralize authority was made after powerful regional groups threatened to withhold their support, and this decentralization has tended to accentuate already existing regional conflicts. However, the regional associations have given the AFN sole authority as spokesman and negotiator on the land claims. It should be noted here that although land served as a stimulus to organization, the AFN is also involved in the other problems of poverty and acculturation which face the natives. Since it is recognized by both the state and federal governments as a spokesman for all Alaska natives, it is becoming the vehicle for the administration of governmental programs such as a recent federal grant for on-the-job training. More important, perhaps, is the fact that although much of the AFN's authority is decentralized along regional lines, the statewide organization is a potential focal point around which the native vote can be mobilized. If they can accomplish this, then the natives will be able to deal from a position of considerable strength on the state level. They represent nearly 30% of the state's electorate, and given the historical pattern of close elections in Alaska, with the possible exception of the late Senator Bartlett, such a block would be significant, and any group able to determine statewide elections can wield a great deal of influence in Juneau. The critical test of the efficacy of the AFN came last May when four white attorneys employed by regional associations wrote letters to former Justice Arthur Goldberg ostensibly on behalf of their clients, but without their prior approval, insinuating improprieties in his conduct as negotiator for the AFN on land claims before Congress. Having stipulated from the beginning that he would not represent the natives unless they were united, Mr. Goldberg viewed these letters as evidence of disunity and resigned as counsel of the AFN. The incident provoked widespread controversy and threatened to destroy the organization. Rumors and misinformation shook many natives' confidence in their leaders, and the interference of the four attorneys raised the specter of outside control. Recognizing both the dangerous implications of this challenge and the political importance of retaining Mr. Goldberg as counsel, the AFN leaders quickly called a meeting of the board of directors, chastised the involved attorneys, and asked for and received a vote of confidence in Mr. Goldberg. Perhaps even more important, regional and local leaders throughout Alaska were indignant over what they saw as the latest white intrusion. They realized more than ever before that in order to obtain an acceptable land settlement, they, not their attorneys, had to determine policy, and that that policy first and foremost necessitated a commitment to unity. As a result, the Goldberg affair proved the AFN a viable political organization which could command the support of its members. The AFN's proposal for an acceptable land claim settlement contains the following elements. 1. Perfect title to approximately 40 million acres of land around their villages. 2. $500 million paid with interest over 9 years. 3. A 2% overriding royalty from the revenues of all other lands. And 4. Of crucial importance, a statewide development corporation with a complementary network of regional corporations controlled by the natives to manage and administer the land and money received under the settlement. For the natives, the issue is tantamount to survival itself. Yet they have consciously chosen the route of conventional politics, utilizing the legitimate channels of negotiation provided by our political system. They chose congressional legislation over a court judgment because the recent experience of the Tlingit-Haida land claim suit, decided by the Court of Claims, demonstrated that a judicial remedy meant interminable delay and inadequate compensation. To help matters, in December 1966, only 2 months after the first statewide Native conference, the then Secretary of Interior, Stuart Udall, proclaimed a freeze on all state land selections until the Native claims were adjudicated. The freeze gave the Natives a bargaining position. Because the then Governor Hickel was committed to a program of rapid economic development, and because the state's treasury desperately needed the potential proceeds from land sales, leases, and mineral royalties, the state was forced to cooperate with the natives in pushing for a rapid settlement. The rich oil discovery on the North Slope last summer helped to reinforce that commitment. The oil discovery also served to prove that the land the natives were giving up was far from worthless, and thus increased their chances of a significant cash settlement. Moreover, it gave Congress a certain maneuverability in providing for alternative methods of financing such a settlement. This bargaining position proved only temporary, however. With the change of administration in January, Udall's freeze was lifted. In its place came only the temporary freeze newly appointed Secretary of the Interior Hickel promised to retain through the 91st Congress. Thus, instead of a freeze protecting Native rights, Secretary Hickel's freeze meant that the Natives had only 2 years in which to obtain an acceptable settlement and reduced their bargaining power accordingly. More likely, it was an expedient move designed to give the semblance of protection to Native rights, while in reality it only meant a delay before exploitation could proceed at full tilt. A bill for settlement is now under consideration in Congress. Fundamentally, it incorporates recommendations made by the Federal Field Committee for Development Planning in Alaska, and in general it provides for a cash settlement of up to $1 billion over 10 years. Implemented through a revenue-sharing plan and some land. It would establish a presidentially controlled Native commission for a life of 10 years to oversee the terms of the settlement. It would also create a Native Development Corporation to be presidentially controlled for at least its first 3 years, which would invest and distribute the proceeds of the settlement. However, Congress as a whole has little direct interest in Alaska. In fact, few members other than the Alaska delegation and those on the Senate and House committees of Interior and Insular Affairs are even aware of the land claims issue. Outside of Congressman Pollock of Alaska, the House committee to date has shown little sympathy or understanding of the Native position. The consistent willingness of Chairman Aspinall to postpone hearings demonstrates some reticence on his part to give the current proposal serious consideration. In a recent interview, a committee staff aide told me that the House subscribes to the theory that federal sovereignty is based on the English feudal law concept that the king owned all land. Thus, the House would never recognize the legitimacy of Indian title, and hence any cash award would be substantially less than what is now being proposed. The Senate committee, on the other hand, has taken a rather positive and responsible position toward settlement. After holding a series of hearings in Alaska and Washington last year, its chairman, Senator Jackson, requested that the Federal Field Committee undertake the comprehensive study now embodied in its report, Alaska Natives and the Land, in order that the Senate committee might have a better understanding of the complex issues involved. He himself introduced the current Senate bill, and although he is not committed to its particular provisions, he is committed to pushing for the passage of legislation in this Congress. Although both of Alaska's senators and its congressmen are members of the Interior Committees, any legislation concerning Alaska necessarily suffers from its lack of political muscle in Washington. With only 3 votes, Alaska exerts little influence. Alaska's natives even less. However, Congress would be much more inclined to pass a settlement if the major parties involved could agree on a single proposal. But as the expiration of the freeze nears, non-Native interests will be less concerned about settling the claims on any terms but their own, as well as less interested in any settlement at all. Primarily, the oil industry wants the land claims settled one way or another in order to get back to business as usual. Publicly, they are in favor of any settlement as long as their investments remain secure. Privately, some oilmen might prefer to deal with the state rather than the natives because it would be easier and probably cheaper to do so. Historically, the oil industry has demonstrated its skill in being able to wield great influence, sometimes amounting to domination over other state governments. Alaska offers an apparently easy target since it needs royalty revenues and since oil is currently its only mineral resource being developed. The federal administration, though, cannot afford to be so casual. The terms of any settlement are vital to the vested interests of several executive departments. The Department of the Interior would cut the Federal Field Committee's proposal for cash settlement in half and spread its payment over a period twice as long. Although it would somewhat increase the acreage allotted the natives, it would withdraw any mineral rights in that land. It also proposes that any Native Commission be an agency of the Department of the Interior and that any Native Development Corporation be controlled by presidential appointees for the first 10 years. In effect, the department's stand is one of reluctance to relinquish its control over the natives and the potential wealth of their land. The Bureau of the Budget agrees with the Department of the Interior. Its main concern is its opposition to any settlement involving revenue sharing from minerals development. Fundamentally, it is unwilling to reevaluate its traditional opposition to any policy other than fixed revenues, even if that would mean a more creative approach. The Department of Agriculture is much less concerned about the cash settlement than it is about the land award. It opposes any land withdrawals from the national forests, especially the access routes to marketable timber areas, on the theory that such withdrawals would adversely affect the Forest Service's longstanding multiple use policy. Historically, this policy has tended to favor the interests of the lumber industry, and there is as yet no evidence to deny this bias here. The state administration, in principle, has voiced its support of the field committee's proposal. But by raising the cloudy argument that revenue sharing might be in conflict with the state's constitution, Governor Miller has opposed diverting any state revenues from mineral leases into the native settlement. Essentially, the state is reticent to support any proposal that would involve a commitment of its own resources. However, even the Federal Field Committee's proposal does not approach the natives' criteria for an acceptable settlement. While the natives have asked for 40 million acres of land, the Field Committee proposes 5. While the natives seek a perpetual royalty interest in the land they cede is commensurate with its real value, the committee proposes such a royalty for only 10 years and to a maximum of $1 billion. And while the natives continually emphasize the importance of controlling the management of their own money and land, the field committee proposes control by presidential appointees. Even in the face of this unfavorable political situation, the native leaders have maintained a moderate posture. How long they will be able to sustain this is another question. Pressures are developing among the natives for a more radicalized, unconventional politics. The natives' acceptance of a negative self-image imposed by years of colonialism created intense frustration and confusion reflected in their high incidence of alcoholism and suicide. During the last several years, however, the natives have begun to resist the white man's image of themselves and have replaced it with a developing sense of pride and dignity. Their political struggle has reinforced this positive self-image, while it has at the same time led to an increased realization of white resistance to end colonialism. These changes have become increasingly apparent among the younger natives, who have begun to advocate a more militant stance as the prospects dim for a dignified settlement through the legitimate channels of the political process. As most Americans, they too are cognizant of the patterns of violence that have emerged in the lower 48. The native leaders are keenly aware of these pressures and are able to contain them so long as an acceptable settlement seems possible. However, either a continued delay in achieving settlement or the imposition of an inadequate settlement can only unleash the forces of anger and indignation, laying a groundwork for violence and its resulting cycle of increased bitterness and alienation.
Because I think some of the people are getting hot from the sun as well as the topic. And to allow these people sitting on the floor to stretch their legs, we'll take a break before we have a discussion. Visitors, observers, and commentators who has been on this campus before and more than once and has always contributed a lot to our conferences. We'll start off the discussion. Professor Jim Lotz of the Canadian Research Center for Anthropology, St. Paul University, Ottawa.
This may quite possibly be my last appearance on the University of Alaska campus, for a variety of reasons. For one thing, yesterday I was called an Englishman. I noticed one of the objections to the law, the settlement of Indian claims and Eskimo claims in Alaska, is that something about English common law. Well, to betray my English cultural heritage, one of the things you must realize about the English, as soon as you learn the rules of the game, they change the rules. This is how rugby football got started. I'm supposed to talk about Gum and the native peoples, and I know absolutely nothing about this. And I was sort of, we had an accusation in the last sort of session that there weren't native peoples on the platform, and I'm very glad to be on a platform that contains totally controlled by representatives of another suppressed minority, i.e. the women. I must say also that I'm extremely embarrassed by my presence here. A large number of American social scientists are moving into Canada, and it's what we call academic cultural genocide. I'm not too sure where we picked the phrase up. And I'd like to explain how I got here, because I think how I got here explains a hell of a lot of what's wrong with these sorts of things. They put my name on the program, and there's always an illusion that I live in the north. I live in Ottawa during the winter, and that's enough. I never wintered over in the north, and God willing, never shall. And they put my name on the program, and they said they were going to pay my fare from Whitehorse to Fairbanks. And I said, I'm very sorry, I don't live in Whitehorse. You know, all kind of looks alike. And then I came up last month, and somebody put in a phone call, and lo and behold, I was told there was money available for me. I didn't know whether it was oil and gas money or whether it's National Science Foundation. So I don't know whether I'm here in the cause of covert greed or a pure science. I would suggest that it's cost about $627 to bring me up and talk to you about natives and the government. And I would suggest there are better uses for that $627. But as with any satisfaction, I got out of mowing the lawn this week down in Ottawa. And I've got another conference next week in Montmorency on leisure. And we're going to work like hell. So I may finally get out of mowing the lawn until such time as the crabgrass takes over. I would point out that I have a terrible problem of ambivalence. I work for the Canadian Research Center for Anthropology, and I'm not an anthropologist. And I work for the Catholic Church, and I'm not a Catholic. Now, if some of the native peoples are talking about ambivalence, I'd like to explain something about them when I have 3 or 4 days to spare. I also have this business of role confusion. I don't know what to do as a discussant. I have a feeling if it was a woman was here, it would be called nagging. Also, I'm a professor. And everybody says, well, of course, the native peoples need training. You know, I never took training to be a professor. I never took a course on being a professor. You know, I think this is one of the sort of myths that somehow you have to sort of go through certain rules and regulations before you can get certain positions. But the professor, which is a high-status person, I'm informed, in our society, requires no special training. Now, we have done something else about inviting poor people, and I don't... It's a question of actually monetary poverty versus what you might call spiritual poverty, I think, basically. Invite them and sort of say, look, we can't make you queen for a day, what, we make you professor for an evening. And once you've paid a low-income person $20 an hour, you know, it does something for them, especially when they're allowed to talk about what they know something about, which is, you know, poverty under the fingernails, not poverty as an abstract. I have a language problem. I was brought up in England, and I was brought up and told that the language that I spoke, the language that I'm using at the present time, is not English. There's a certain sort of English that was spoken over the BBC. I subsequently found out, if you watch the English TV programs, that a large portion of the English media is devoted to outdoor welfare for the upper class, i.e. accumulate an English Oxford or Cambridge accent and you're fixed for life, because you can always play the goodies in the TV movies and this sort of thing. But it was impressed upon me that my language was wrong, that the way I spoke, my particular northern accent, and English, of course, is a very large language, except the English have never been able to do much with it except confuse people. And I was sort of put down on this language business. And now I was delighted to hear last week in another conference that whatever else anybody relates to in Alaska, the villages, people relate to the Beatles. And the Beatles come from where I come from. And one of the things you learn in Liverpool, which is a seaport, is verbal dexterity. There's a lot of talk about development, but in operational terms, development means transferring money and power to people who haven't got them before they take it away from you. Arising out of the research done on the war on poverty, and we use the United States as a distant early warning line, stimulated Canada's economy no end. There is significant evidence, and I go so far as to make this almost a definitive statement, that poor people are people who don't have any money. I think this is getting sort of lost inside of this business. Let's, God's sake, let's start another welfare program. Let's give them some more dough. Now, there are a number of ways to get money, and one of those ways is to scare the hell out the honkies. Now, you'll get money this way. If you ask for $500,000, you get $5 million. So what? $495 million gone, but $5 million profit. With this money will come a great deal of hatred and fear. One of the things I've sort of watched here is all this sort of lovely oil money floating around. Well, Alaska may get it, it may not. I gather after yesterday's dissertation by one of the members of the oil firms, they're passing the hat to pay his airfare back to Texas. I think what is being lost sight of is a very significant thing in the north, the boom and the bust. You have to decide what you could do under the best possible conditions and under the worst possible conditions. Now, everybody says, where are we going? Where are we going? See? The question is, where do you start? And I think you have to start with real people, not with abstracts. And I must say that, you know, the clichés are comforting after a while, but in my country, in Canada, we're, you know, getting through this, breaking through this cliché barrier, and I think we're getting down to the real problems of real people, and not those dreamed up in government offices outside. I get the feeling that everybody's sort of getting rid of their, you know, having this cathartic thing, which is very good for people up to a certain point. And I got a good laugh yesterday when I said, of course, in Canada we are solving our employment problems among our native peoples by having them study white people. I have a project dear to my heart which is available for funding if I have 5 minutes to write down the budget, and that's the White Anglo-Saxon Protestant Research Institute. And we're not going to interfere with the White Anglo-Saxon Protestants, we're just going to research on them. I would suggest, however, that although they're not getting paid for it, these native peoples are studying us. They're watching us. And I think also they know who their friends are by now. It sort of upsets me when I come into Alaska, which is almost as good as Canada. Sorry about this nationalist. We're trying for nationalism without chauvinism in Canada, and we're almost getting there. There's a definition of a Canadian as someone who apologizes when somebody stands on his foot. I was talking to a group of Upward Bounders last month, and I said, look, you Eskimos, Indians, sorry, you Alaskans. I can't tell the difference, I'm sorry, as an outsider. All you Alaskans look the same to me. And I've seen in very sort of informal ways and friendly ways the ways in which people sort of transcend these so-called cultural compartments or cultural barriers. In other words, I think things are being done here, and I think considerable things are being done here, because I've been in and out of Alaska since 1961. Sometimes I've been invited, but initially it was a sense of preservation, self-preservation. I think there are a number, you know, we're hung up with this science model about what can you measure? And this is my definition of Canada's northern settlement, is the affluent society. And there are certain things like getting pure water into the villages and getting protein into the kids. I have to teach missionaries, and that's a very difficult thing to do, you see, because, you know, they get preached at most of the time, and you've got to give them orders. And, you know, the simple things like get pure water in, and get rid of the affluent, and put protein into the kids. I'm very much against this concept of somebody coming in from outside and dishing out a few recipes and getting the hell out to more comfortable climes. I'm not here sort of officially, though I'm familiar with it. I'm not here to officially any mention, extensive mention, of Frank Darnell's Alaska Rural School Project, which I think is a good thing. I'm not here to great talk about Lee Salisbury's Copan Project. The point I'm making, I know these things, is that somebody wandering in from outside would never know about these things, you know. The work of George Rogers and Dick Cooley, I don't think anybody working in northern development in Canada could put pen to paper without the work that George Rogers and Dick Cooley has done. When we finally got around to looking at our north, the person who had to be called in was George Rogers. Incidentally, here's a commercial. There's a couple of films which I made when I was here last month on Copan, Alaska Rural School Project, and these are available to those who have videotape facilities. And that's a commercial. If there's anybody wants to pay any money, I've signed a release to the University of Alaska, and I feel sure in the hands of people like Frank and Lee, the money will get back to the native peoples. I would suggest that one of the things that seems to be lacking in our northern part of Canada is a common sense of humanity. I think this is the thing that the north does to you. I think you sort of get out there and you feel that, my God, you know, how did I get here, first of all? You know, how powerful I am. And this strange feeling of insignificance of, you know, the might of the physical environment. And I think whatever the north is doing to people, I think it's making them aware of the fact that, you know, you have to have a common humanity. This transcends all these quaint cultural barriers. Again, in the conference, everybody talked about the split between the native people and the white people, and there's quite obviously a split in this conference between the people who are saying we should do this, or the if-as. Dr. Glass mentioned, you know, if we'd only known about the thalidomide tragedy. We did. There was a German doctor who sort of spoke out against this, and the drug companies put the detectives after him. And I think the situation, as far as science is concerned, if you speak the truth, you'll get clobbered. There's another group of people sort of waiting and who are actually doing things, and I think a considerable amount's going on in Alaska. I think we owe a great debt. The more I spend time in Canada, the more pro-American I become and the more anti-English, quite frankly. And I've sort of liked the openness and the honesty and the generosity of Americans. I'm deeply in the debt of the generosity of a man like George Rogers for sharing with me his ideas. And anything I do in the North will be strictly a kind of a footnote to what George and Dick and people like that are doing. We had an educational conference last month. You know, and the Canadians and Americans, I suppose it's a national characteristic. Sort of chucked their guts on the table and said, you know, mea culpa, we've sinned, you know, we've been bad, etc. And the Russians just said, nyet problemi. So if anybody's interested, the Russians have solved all the problems, human problems in the north. We got the impression that perhaps in some remote spot, there was an old Eskimo who had not committed the entire works of Lenin to memory, but they were working on that. It seems to me also that you're sort of geographically bound in Alaska. I think Alaska's more a kind of a state of mind, you know. I think you shouldn't be sort of worried about when I come to Alaska, it's like coming home. When I go to the lower 48, quite frankly, it scares the hell out of me. The other thing, too, that I called a Russian a bureaucrat, and he got very upset. And I told him, what do you do with dropouts who drop out and won't obey? And they said, you know, as we have in Canada, he said, send them to Russia. And I said, well, if you care to invite some of our dropouts, they'd be delighted to come and talk with you people. But, of course, he didn't take this up. I would suggest that the BIA people who I've met, and I've been kindly treated by these people, maybe because they treat, you know, idiots kindly, and the oil company people are human beings as well. And I think one of the things I've disliked in Canada, I spent 5 years in the bureaucracy and I escaped. And I'm familiar with the sort of thing that happens, that, you know, the crisis arrives at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And I'm afraid if anybody's going to play the game of thump the bureaucrat, they can include me out. I think a lot could be done by going to, say, our Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development, the Indian Affairs part of which will be abolished in 5 years' time, so the Indians lose a scapegoat, and going to some of these people and say, what do you want to do? You know, ask these government people, what do you want to do? And if they say, I'd love to go fishing, say, well, as of Monday, go fishing. You see? It's a lot cheaper in the long run to pay people to do what they want to do, because in this egalitarian age, they're damn well going to do it anyhow. Now, the question is, you know, what can be done with the available sort of talents, ability, and, you know, this enormous flood of money if it comes, and what's going to happen if it doesn't come? Now, my feeling generally is that, you know, we know all we need to know. Seems to be lacking a sort of sense of guts. All the evidence I've had here from the conference and talking informally, which are two different things, is I think the native peoples in Alaska are in pretty good shape. I think from this disquisition by Dr. Wolf, I think this was an indication of that they know how to play the game. They're playing it extremely successfully. And if anybody wants to say, what do we do with the native peoples? I would suggest they send them to our native peoples. At least you've got four lawyers you can work with in Alaska. And I was at a conference, not a conference, a meeting. A group of Indians were trying to con $4 million out of the Canadian government and invited me in as a consultant. And they're not going to get it, by the way. That's another story. And I said, how many lawyers have you got you can trust with this claims thing coming up? They said, one. I said, it seems to me, you know, you've got a problem. That's your problem. Finding lawyers you can trust. Now, what I'm going to sort of say, you know, I'm always a believer in sort of expressing naked self-interest rather than sort of covering it up with altruism. And again, I think the North forces honesty on you. We have a Ford program going at our center, which the favorite system in Canada, and when we have a problem, is to get an American Foundation grant. It's known as, while you're up, get me a grant. And we're trying to solve Canadian problems with American money. And Ford has sort of really sort of upped the ante and come in with a $15,000 a year per capita program to train leaders. You know, we have lots of Charge of the Light Brigade type of leaders in Canada. You know, there are the guns sort of thing. And, oops, sorry, it wasn't my fault. It's yours. See the charge? The native people should see the Charge of the Light Brigade. They'll see what they're up against. And what we're trying to do, I think we're trying to do, because I'm not sure, quite frankly. It's going to depend on the other people and myself working together, is to develop sort of social technologists. As far as the mechanical technology is concerned, I think that to a very real extent, I think our native peoples are going to be shut out. But there's going to be an increase in science and technology, and we're in the era when we're really going to do social technology. And I don't mean sensitivity training, you know, 2 days of sensitivity training. I mean social science technology. We're roughly at the age now, as far as, say, industrial things are concerned, as far as social things are concerned, where we were about 1650, as far as mechanical things are concerned, you know. There's almost a 300-year lag, and we have to sort of, in the name of humanity and science and common sense, we have to close this gap. These people involved in this four-program are non-graduates. They're not university graduates, which, to my way of thinking, means they have less to unlearn. As one who got thrown out of a university, not dropout, mind you, thrown out. Everybody was worried about the dropouts, but there's too few throwouts for us to organize a pressure group. There's a girl who is now with the Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research, Julie Cruikshank, who did an excellent study on the Indian women in change and hasn't got any of the answers, but has got a lot of damn good questions. What we're involved with is things like stimulating information flows, studies of isolation. You know, as Margaret Lantis pointed out, in 1952, you know, it was agreed that there should be a study of whites in the North done, and we sort of started this a couple of years ago. A very good girl called Hilary White. I would make the point out that the women seem to do better in the social technology sort of section than the men do, at least in my feeling. We're a very small organization. You know, the longer the title, the smaller the organization. And we're a very small organization, but we managed to get together with Indian Eskimo Association, and we have brought Mary Carpenter, who's an Eskimo from Iqaluit, on a kind of a leadership training program. She said she'd like to come to Alaska, so we did what we could to get her here. She's got a return ticket. What she does here isn't, you know, is entirely up to her. You can't be experts in the lives of other people, which is incidentally a phrase I picked up and pinched from an American, Friedenberg. We found out, you see, that you can't do all things for all men. You have to concentrate. And where the concentration comes is on youth. We have a young person, and I wish he'd be here instead of me, because coming to Alaska, I enjoy Alaska and it's fun, but to him it would be a great thing, because he's never been to Alaska and he has a great deal of sort of nitty-gritty knowledge. I think that phrase is out, by the way. We suffer from cultural lag in Canada, among other things. And his option, actually, is joining the bureaucracy, something called the Company of Young Canadians, who have the mission to start social change in Canada. We still have this belief that social change is something we white start, you know. It's something you kind of grab hold of as it goes past. And we've got out the messianic stage. And his option, actually, is either joining the Company of Young Canadians or being thrown into jail. He went out of town during the summer to avoid a rather inconvenient matter connected with an insurance claim against him. And I had to explain to the insurance adjuster that the reason he couldn't be found was out of town. He was earning money to play the claim. That kept him quiet for a moment. His option, actually, is either to go in the government, in the bureaucracy, in the Company of Young Canadians, or to go to jail. He was in town for 5 minutes, and he was harassed twice by the police. I don't know how it stacks up in the States, but we're not worried about police brutality in Canada. We're worried about police stupidity. I would suggest that the sort of thing we've been looking at, now I've got to give you a model because I'm a social scientist. Since I came to University of Alaska, I've been got a degree in sociology, and according to the my biography, I've got a degree in geology, which is, you know, more than I've got. I've already got a couple of degrees than I ever came with. And you have to sort of think in terms of not, you know, how do we keep the natives quiet, or how do we sort of, you know, help them to sort of make furniture out of packing crates, you know, and this sort of thing, and, it's, you know, and how, you know, to make drapes out of flour sacks and this sort of thing. You know, if they want drapes, they'll make drapes. Eh? And what's, you know, what's wrong? Why do we have drapes, you know, sort of thing. And, you know, we're spending a lot of time and effort trying to get the native peoples off the floor in Canada because, you know, they keep on making this furniture out of packing crates, then they keep sitting on the floor, you know, and it's very upsetting, you know. See, the trouble is we brought in white urban middle class, and again, I've been out the north for 3 years, and I'm now white urban middle class, and I'll tell you one thing, if you're in Canada, I fought my way into the middle class, and I'm not going to see it vanish now. I think one of the biggest problems that the native peoples have is distinguishing between signals and noise, the signal-to-noise ratio. In other words, so many messages spewed out of them, they don't know who to trust. I think this is one of the characteristics. A shortage of accurate information that delimits the limits of the possible, which, as far as I'm concerned, is what science is about. It seems also that as far as our young people are concerned in Canada, they need a role, and I would suggest a role for young people from Alaska. And I think there is this tendency to sort of see Alaskans' problems as problems of Alaska. I think over the next 20 or 30 years in the lower 48, you're going to need some people who are acceptable to what I would term both sides, black and white, rich and poor, call them what you will. And the fact of coming from Alaska immediately puts people in the lower 48 in a kind of a neutral position, in neutral ground. And the sort of model, I don't like calling it a model because I don't know what a model is the hourglass. And what you need are people at the center, at the middle of this neck of this hourglass. Here's the native peoples, here's the bureaucracy, and you need people at the neck of this hourglass, just passing messages back and forwards. We've used our university for this. Just simply telling people the limits of the possible, and then getting it, letting them go to it. And if they make a mistake and if they fail, they don't get laughed at. Somebody says, well, that's one option, you didn't, you know, you try and it didn't work out. And this business of, you know, that learning is an intensely risky, difficult, and dangerous business. If you want a sign, and since I work for Catholic University, I better provide a sign as well as a model, be on the safe side. I once ended a paper, I think I've seen in the north, the horns of caribou locked together, and, you know, a pile of bones on either side. And to me, that's a very obvious sign. And I was on Arctic expeditions, again, another sort of thing that I wandered into without knowing what I was doing. And up on the north, about 83 degrees north, you know, you see lichens. Lichen is a symbiosis between an algae and a fungi. They live together. Without each other, they can't live. Together, they, you know, they can bring life, and that is life, you know. It's supposed to be a very primitive form, but you see all the lichens sitting around talking about those primitive people up there, you know, that primitive form of life that keeps on scraping us up. I've pretty well not sort of acted as a discussant because I think, again, I was, like so many native peoples, I was put into a role in which I am not fitted. I have nothing in my humility, and I suppose in my sense of survival, I have nothing to offer to this debate. The only suggestion I could make is next time you have a symposium and you do have someone to talk about the native peoples, please do not bring me. Please do put a native person here and have him tell you what I just don't know. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Lotz. Now then, which hand goes up first? Yes.
I'd be interested in knowing what is being done in the lower 48. So I mentioned this to Swope before and all. As far as advertising and publicity, and she mentioned something about CBS has taken up the cause and other things. And I'd like to know, for us here who will be watching the programs, who will be involved in things like that, what is being done to involve other people who have power to influence legislation and different states and inevitably of the National Congress? So what kind of work is being done on getting people mixed up in these movements like the Black Movement, the lower 48 itself?
Ms. Wolf, and then if there's anyone else in the audience who can answer this question, I'd like to have you volunteer.
Is Charlie Edwardson still here? I think Charlie should answer the question, since he's been the one involved in most of this.
We now have an organization called the Friends of Alaska Natives, and all of you people are eligible. Therefore, I do not discriminate, but however we have a simple fee for $5, $25, $50, $100, and if you are a corporation, we also have some corporate fees which are negotiable. We do not take scrip or IOUs. And I'm in an organization called the Friends of Alaska Natives in Washington, D.C., which has able little things, and we're doing that. And we're moving along slowly but surely, and we need some funds. So if anyone wants to advocate the position of the native land claims, I'll take your money. And the name of the organization is, and we also have an IRS status, which is legitimate in government terms. And the name of the organization is Friends of Alaska Natives Incorporated. Mall 2016 Northwest Washington, D.C. And we're coalescing our efforts among the populated states where the votes are. And we talk to a lot of organizations, a lot of and in this market, there's one thing that I learned to do was to talk with a lot of little old ladies. So most of the ladies here are more than welcome.
Okay, thank you. I think that Mrs. Jones would like to answer a question that was given to her informally from someone in the office. We'll give her a chance to reply.
Do you want me to go?
Well, might be better.
One of the health, education, and welfare people suggested that it wasn't clear whether I was talking about state or federal agencies in my paper. The welfare agency is a state agency that I was discussing, and the education agency is a state agency, and the Alaska Native Service is part of the federal U.S. Public Health Service. This person pointed out that it might be a good idea for us to realize that these changes have to be made here in our state, and they're not something we can just say a matter of federal responsibility.
Okay, in the back in the center.
I'd like to direct a question to Dr. Jones. She mentioned that there were, we all know that, well, first of all, you might mention that I worked for last year in the health service. But she mentioned that some of the unmet health needs that are, well, particularly she mentioned in Alaska, and I think we all, any of us that know anything about it, of course, realize and recognize these unmet health needs, but what I'm wondering is how do you propose to, do you have any specifics on how we might get these hospitals in these smaller committees with only 200 people? We all recognize the need and the problem, but do you have any answers for it?
Well, I don't know your financial situation, and if you're equipped to provide some kind of regional facility. You see, in the Aleutians, a regional facility would cause a great deal less stress because people know each other. People know others in other villages, and it's not such a stress to go from one Aleut community to another as it is to go to the city.
So then you weren't really saying that, that there should be a hospital in each of these facilities of towns of several hundred people, but
no.
rather a region.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'd like to respond to Dr. Jones' comment about the Native Health Service. I'm Dr. Lee as a director. He made the comment that the Native Health Service has a system designed for care of a middle-class person. I would say that our system is actually unique to the United States and one of the unique systems in the world. I'd like to take just a moment to explain very briefly how we do deliver health services. First of all it is a comprehensive health program. We do provide a full range of services, curative, preventive, and rehabilitative. But you do realize we do have limitations, and I'll be the first to admit that we are not meeting all of the needs fully, although we have made some big strides. The the basic health personnel is the native person who lives in the village. We train and contract for health aid services in all of the villages in Alaska, approximately 155 villages. There are close to 180, but there are about 155 villages which are large enough to use health aides. The health aides are native people trained by us, who work through our seven service units through radio communication with the physicians. We do work hand-in-hand with the state public health nursing services. We contract for these services. Our program is primarily oriented at getting out into the villages, using these seven hospitals as our base of operations. The emphasis is on prevention, it's on providing services at the village level, using the people living in the village. We also are attempting to involve the native person, the community, as much as possible in the planning and the decision making of the health services.
Of course, some of the old timers remember the mobile units that we used to have in Alaska, the railroad car, the boats on the Yukon and on the coast, and other mobile units. Now, these were quite expensive to operate. Perhaps newer forms of mobile units should be considered, perhaps regional clinics, if not hospitals. It may be that some new devices are needed. I think those of you who are new should realize that various forms for delivering health services have been tried in the past. There was a highway unit at one time, I believe, going up and down the highway to take health services to local people. Today, naturally, we depend more on the plane. We haven't arrived at the end of the line, I hope. I would like to put that in, that some innovations can be contemplated. Now, we're not the people to say exactly what they should be. Yes.
I think there's one message which should be understood here. is not to be over defensive of what agency or whose failure that has happened. And there is, we have over identified certain problems, and here is with Mrs. Wolf's paper is a tool, and with along with Native Development, this is here is an instrumentation, a vehicle that the Native community of Alaska has implemented and has utilized, and this is a tool under this type of organization which put things into confrontation or into some form of resolution. And if, I say if we want to further carry out these problems, resolutions, whatever terminology is acceptable under whatever agency that we emphasize, is we have a tool. The tool is there. And the problem has been over identified, and in our achievement, this is simply political force, community organization in lowest form, in its highest form, it's simply organization. How do we organize to resolve a problem? That's all.
Yes, somebody has.
Yes, I have two questions. The first, it seems almost remarkable to me, the sort of veiled optimism about these Native rights claims. I mean, they started off talking about 80 million acres, and it's down to 14 now by Governor Miller. There's easement been given underneath the pipe all the way across Alaska from the Natives. And if you look to America, on the continental United States, what's happened to the Indians, you know, it seems clear what's going to happen in Alaska. And Eagle just 2 weeks ago said that they've been too soft on the Indians, and they ought to send them back to the reservations. He said that almost, quote, in the Seattle meeting. So, I mean, I wonder, what is the basis of all the optimism that people have here?
Who wants to answer that?
That's an incorrect remark, for one thing. I'm sorry, Mark.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of our late governor. I think that he would probably be the first to admit that. But I think it's completely taken that out of context. And, you know, your point is well taken that the land claim itself has been eroded in its size. Our next governor did not say that. You know, all he said was that the federal government had to foster the greater dependency on Indians, and that what was really the idea was to eliminate this dependency. And isn't that what everybody here is talking about? I mean, you know, he is unfortunate. He's one of these kind of people. Whatever he says, good morning, you want to punch him in the head. But it doesn't necessarily mean that this is a wrong statement.
Well, I want to argue about Hinkle. The point is, I mean, given the experience of American Indians on the continent, and given the erosion of the claims that exist, and given the role that the oil companies have, what is the basis for optimism? There's been no political discussion here of the means of organization to achieve their end. Very little.
Well, I will say this in defense of our speakers. They did have a time limit. There's a lot more that could be given on the organization. Yes, you will.
I would make a point here that I think, I don't know about Alaska, but if you weren't optimistic in northern Canada, you just wouldn't stay. I think it's a question of optimism is part of the northern sort of situation. And combined with optimism, I think, is also a sense, because of the feedback from the environment, of realism. I would suggest also that one of the things that is happening here is suggesting sort of forecasting possible futures. And one of the terrible things about linear mechanical society is that if you forecast a particular set of events, you may then sort of carry forward events to bring these things about, you know, to bring these about. It seems to me, as far as discussing political organization of the Native peoples, I have never in all my born days come across people who've been so politically organized. We talk about these things. These people are empirical. They go and do it. And this business of optimism is a very real characteristic of the North. And I think this is a cultural characteristic, and I think being optimistic and realistic is what a Northerner is all about. I think this distinguishes you from the Lower 48. I think this term concrete mechanisms is, you know, the very language, you know, is... I don't think you need sort of concrete mechanisms. I think this concept of a concrete mechanism indicates our mechanistic thinking, our machine thinking. Well, I'll tell you one thing, change doesn't come about because a lot of people in a hot room sort of discuss words. I don't think this is... Eh? I mean, how... Yeah. Change comes about in this concept by passing $5 over to Charlie Edmondson and saying, I'm joining the Alaska Federation of Natives. That's how change comes about, putting money and power into people's hands, not words. I think this business about, what do we do here? One suggestion, I think there'll be a meeting tomorrow of sort of informal in Moore Hall. See, nobody ever pays attention to the women. The men do all the talking. Should pay attention to the women. See, listen to the women, because they're going to be the ones who make the decisions, because the children are in their hands. And they are not, in real life terms, going to see the life chances of their children stunted. Yet one thing, too, is as far as Alaska and northern Canada is concerned, you need a high level of science and technology. It's a capital-intensive area. Now, this knowledge and this science and technology doesn't...